Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everyone, wherever you are in the world. This is a Design for Living, a big book meeting of Overeaters Anonymous. And my name is Z, and I'm a compulsive eater, and I'll be your chairperson for today's meeting. To open the meeting, let's have a moment of quiet meditation followed by the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things that I cannot change, the courage to change the things that I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. We start this meeting by remembering our common purpose, to extend the heart and hand of the OA Fellowship to those who still suffer. Let us be mindful of OA's unity with diversity policy, which respects our differences yet unites us in the solution to our common problem. Whatever problem that you may have with food, you are welcome at this meeting. Today, we are delighted to have Patrick joining us to share his experience, strength, and hope focused on the topic of two employers. So I would like to welcome Patrick to the group. Welcome, Patrick. Really grateful to have you here.
My name is Patrick, and I'm a compulsive eater. And I just want to thank all of you for your presence here. I'm not a guy that's supposed to be on this call today. And if I think, Steph, you have my photos, if you could post those, I'll do a little explanation. The one you see at the top there is me at the 2015 International AA Convention. I'm a member of both fellowships. At that point, I was 420 pounds with severe type 2 diabetes, chronic neuropathy in both my legs. And I can that photograph was taken at a barbecue restaurant. The photo on the bottom of this slide is 3 years later. And the woman you see in the photo is a responsible recovered member of Overeaters Anonymous, who, after seeing me there, they invited me to lunch that day. And then she took me aside, and I'll get into that a little bit in my story. I put on 100, I had a, I almost drank myself to death at age 43, and food has always been a problem for me. When I did my first step in Overeaters Anonymous, I realized that food was the first thing I used to alter my internal dialogue. I've had the spiritual malady in my life since I was born, and the 12 steps are what the spiritual malady treat. We're going to get into my employers here in a little bit, and I really think it's interesting. You know, if you read the first three pages about of two employers, they talk about the fatality of this disease, right? Now, granted, this is alcoholism that they're writing about in the big book, but I overeaters, you know, this disease nearly killed me as I was a member of a 12-step fellowship telling you that I was living a spiritual life. And there's nothing spiritual about that. I was dying. And if not for a responsible recovered member of Overeaters Anonymous, you'd have somebody else on this screen today. She confronted my illness. She was willing to 12-step me. She was willing to tell me the truth about the nature of my condition and share her recovery. And she shared that with a guy who had the first 164 pages of this book memorized, who'd been flying around the country doing AA talks, right? Living in duality, talking about a program that I wasn't working, asking other people to do things that I wasn't willing to do, like, you know, 10, 11, and 12 in particular, right? Sharing on step 11 and not actually having a meditation line, writing inventory only when I'm just under the gun instead of daily as it recommends. Right? What Overeaters Anonymous gave me was an ability to be rigorously disciplined in the application of these spiritual principles to my life, to practice these principles in all my affairs. You know, the big book talks about on page 19 that a more important demonstration of our principles in our homes, occupations, and affairs. I can log on to this Zoom meeting and sound really good for the next hour. But what happens when I click out? What happens when nobody's watching? And you know, I wish my problem was food. Food is just what I use to treat my problem. And yes, I have a physical allergy to certain ingredients in foods, sugar being a major one, which is the first thing that I was addicted to. You know, they used to find me in my home. I'd be sitting on the kitchen floor of my home when I was 3 or 4 years old, and I would have a 2-pound bag of chocolate baking chips, you know, the kind you make chocolate chip cookies with. And I would have eaten the whole thing. And, you know, they'd find me smeared in chocolate and they'd, oh, he's a mischievous child. So they'd hide the bag the next time. And guess what? I'd find it. Right. And so I think it's my understanding, or it's my belief that I've had this illness from the beginning of my life. I was the kid that at 5 or 6 years old, I'd be standing in front of the refrigerator, staring into that wonderful abyss, just grabbing whatever I could to put in my mouth, right? And I was always overweight, but I wasn't morbidly overweight. I was a husky kid. I was chubby, but I didn't get into really morbid, health-threatening obesity until after I got sober in AA in 2003. And by the way, I had to have a triple bypass at 5 years sober, and I put on 160 pounds after that. I don't know anybody that would recommend that as a recovery process from a triple bypass on your heart. I nearly drank myself to death, drank and ate myself to death, and then I nearly ate myself to death again. And I remember waking up from that surgery, thinking to myself, well, now I can eat whatever I want. And when I went through the work in Overeaters Anonymous, I realized that, you know, our car salesman friend back in More About Alcoholism, where he talks about suddenly the thought crossed my mind to pour whiskey into my milk. And everybody giggles about somebody pouring whiskey into milk because it sounds terrible. But the real danger in that phrase is suddenly the thought crossed my mind. Because I'm helpless in the face of food, utterly and completely powerless. And, you know, so for me, this is a gift to be here with all of you today. It's a privilege that I never thought I'd have. It moves me to be able to share what I've experienced in this fellowship and what I've experienced as a result of working the steps in this book, and the freedom that I live in from that obsession today. You can see the difference. And it's not just the physical transformation. Mind, body, I can report to you, and others in my life will report to you, that my mind, my body, and my spirit all move in the same general direction, right? That there's a unity to my consciousness now. I always used to think that my body was something that I used to treat this sick thing between my ears, right? And now it's all connected, which makes me useful in the world, which which allows me a meaningful, fulfilling existence as a result of being connected to a power greater than myself. And all of you in these fellowships and all of the other people in my life. So if you're new here, I want to report to you something. What we have here is something called what is available in Overeaters Anonymous is what I like to call authentic recovery. The book refers to permanent recovery. And I'm about to say something that gets me in a little bit of trouble occasionally, but I'm going to say it, because I think it gets thrown around 12-step fellowships a little too loosely. Relapse is not a part of recovery, and relapse is part of my story. So I want to be real careful. I've relapsed in OA. Relapse is not a part of recovery. It's a symptom of the disease. What is available as a result of working these 12 steps is what's described in the book as permanent recovery. And it's described in two places. It's described in the foreword to the second edition, and it's described in the preface to Dr. Bob's story. They use the word permanent recovery because that's what's available. And again, I've had to restart my abstinence date in Overeaters Anonymous twice. I first came into Overeaters Anonymous in the summer of 2015. My most recent back-to-back black and white abstinence date is August 26th of 2020. I've been relieved of 220 pounds and I no longer have type 2 diabetes. It's in full remission. I no longer require diabetic medication. I've lost four toes, two on both feet, or two on each foot. The first two toes of each foot have had been amputated as long-term consequences of this illness. I nearly lost my right leg to an infection that I got in my foot that resulted, thankfully, in the amputation of those first two feet. So I'm certainly qualified to be here. And I'm grateful to be here. But I take recovery with a serious tone because I always believe that there's somebody on here that needs to hear it, needs to hear that they no longer need to suffer, that they no longer need to live with the obsession of food, that you can be free, freedom from the bondage of self, freedom from the bondage of the idea that you're just going to spin into some sort of a miserable existence, trying to avoid. Because if I have to spend the rest of my life avoiding food, shoot me now. I can't do that. I need something in my life that allows me what they describe in the promises, the 10-step promises, which is that I'm safe and protected. I reach a position of neutrality. So the first three pages of two employers on page 136, it begins, he goes immediately into, and by the way, this was authored by a man named Hank Parkhurst, who was a Standard Oil executive at the time. To Rhonda's point, there are a few chapters in here that were not authored by Bill. To the Wives being one of them. That was done mostly by Lois. But the big book was not exclusively written by Bill Wilson either. It's a compilation of the first 100. It was sent out for edits. It was sent out for suggestions. And one of the most important suggestions that ever came about this is God as we understand him, your own conception of God. Because I was anti-God when I came into 12-step recovery. If you said to me, God, when I came in, we were going to have a problem. So that is one of the single most important things that other people contributed to this fellowship was your own conception of God, right? That you don't have to have any adherence to anything specific. You can come up with your own description of a power greater than yourself, which is great, because what they talk about in To the Employers is about how do you approach somebody that's struggling with this illness, right? To the Employers is really sort of a 12, there's a lot of instructions into the Employers about how to 12-step someone, especially in a work environment, how to make the approach, right? And I don't know about any of you, but when I was in my active food addiction, I was not a very responsible employee. Self-centered to the extreme. I was usually distracted by eating thoughts, like, what am I going to have at first break? What am I going to have at lunch? Do I have enough candy in my desk? That kind of thing, right? Or I was resentful and fearful. I was suffering from the things we find in the fourth column of a completed inventory. I'm selfish. I'm dishonest. I'm fearful, right? I'm self-centered to the extreme. You know, remember that our book tells me in the run-up to step three that I'm an extreme example of self-will run riot. you know, and everybody kind of chuckles when we bust out that statement, but what it says right after that is, though he usually doesn't think so. So I'm running around in a state of delusion, thinking that I'm being magnanimous and having integrity at work. And the truth is, I'm creating havoc, chaos. And I can report to you that my work history would reflect that as an active food addict. I've changed jobs a lot because I'm the guy that senses, well, they're probably about to fire me anyway, so I just better go find something quick. That hasn't happened in the last 8 years since I came into Overeaters Anonymous. Any job changes that I've occurred have been initiated by me to advance my career. So if we look at page 136, he talks about Mr. B. He insisted, you know, the first paragraph describes, I was once at one time assistant manager of a corporate department employing 6,600 men. One day my secretary came in saying that Mr. B insisted on speaking with me. I told her to say that I was not interested. I had warned him several times that he had one more chance, but not long afterward called me from Hartwood on two successive days so drunk he could hardly speak. I told him he was through, finally and forever. I, you know, maybe he didn't get drunk, but did you ever call in sick because you were binge eating or feeling the effects of a binge, having been up all night? I mean, I'm looking at heads do the bob on the screen, which I appreciate. Thank you for confirming that I'm not alone in that endeavor, right? I told him he was through finally and forever. My secretary returned to say that it was not Mr. B on the phone. It was Mr. B's brother, and he wished to give me a message. I still expected a plea for clemency, but these words came through the receiver. Just wanted to tell you, Paul jumped from a hotel window in Hartford last Saturday. He left us a note saying you were the best boss he ever had and that you were not to blame in any way. You know, in order for the steps 2 through 12 to be actuated in a human being's life, you have to be utterly convinced that that's the case for you, that that this disease is persistent, chronic, and potentially fatal in your life. Because otherwise, why would you? Have you ever had anybody that doesn't suffer from addiction run up to you and say, hey, I'm really interested in doing a 4-step? It's never happened to me, right? Have you ever had anybody, you know, talk about needing to practice these principles in all of your affairs? No, they just do it. You know, it's really important for a first to have an experience with step one, not an opinion of it. And sometimes what happens is we get stuck on the dash in step one. I'm willing to admit that I'm powerless over food, but I'm going to manage some areas in my life, right? Anybody in here have any issues other than food, like spending or you know, I'm going to say it out loud, issues with sex or issues with gambling, or, you know, go down the list. The big book calls them sprees. And these are created by the spiritual malady, any of which will eventually get me back to the refrigerator, right? And in back in the food. See, my disease wants me dead. It'll settle for me in the food, and it'll do anything to get me there. It'll convince me that my poor performance at work is my boss's fault. Right? It'll get me pointing the direction instead of taking me into the inventory process, reporting to that when someone immediately, and taking it into prayer and meditation, seeking God's will in this area, making the amends that I need to make. I'm really good at running around work, pointing my finger at all the people that aren't doing their job very well, and in the meantime, Guess who isn't? I used to be, not anymore. That was one of my favorite activities. I'm the kind of guy you give a job to and 3 days later, I'm telling you that the CEO doesn't know a thing about what he's doing. Like literally within the first week. And just insane that way. Self will run riot. Though he usually doesn't think so. Is it possible you're in more trouble than you think you are? And is it possible that's what's standing between you and a life you can't even begin to imagine how fulfilling and meaningful it could be? Is an opinion about an experience you haven't had yet. Because that's what was killing me. A lot of people, you know, they're in how it works, it talks about, you know, cannot or would not. Well, if you're on this meeting, you're not a cannot, because cannots don't make it here. I was a would not for a long time. And I paid a real heavy price. And so did my family, by the way, because having had to watch me nearly drink myself to death at age 43, 12 years later, they're watching me nearly eat myself to death. You know, my sister watched me have heart attacks during DTs from alcohol. I would detox from alcohol and I would have heart attacks during DTs. And 12 years later, she's watching me put on 160 pounds after a triple bypass, developing type 2 diabetes, having chronic neuropathy in my legs, hardly able to ambulate, to walk more than 1,000 yards maybe at a time. That's not easy for people that love me. You know, I tell people all the time, if you're not sure how other people experience your compulsive eating, ask them. You might get an answer different than the one that's been running around in your head. Another time I opened a letter by which lay on my desk, a newspaper clipping fell out. It was the obituary of one of the best salesmen I ever had. After 2 weeks of drinking, he placed his toe on the trigger of a loaded shotgun. The barrel was in his mouth. I discharged him for drinking 6 weeks before. How many people do you think today might commit suicide as a result of compulsive overeating all over the world? Oh, Patrick, you take it a little too seriously. I pray for those people every night because I sat for months in the run-up to that convention before I went to contemplating that very thing, because I was like, well, I got sober, now I got this thing, why me? Right? I was entertaining the possibility of suicide as a result of this disease. Maybe not all of you have gotten there, and if you haven't, that's good, you don't need to, but I was there. Because when life has no real purpose or no real excitement, no vitality to it, what is it? This day-to-day existence of me just feeding this monster I have and gaining weight and living, you know, isolating and not able to connect with other people and not feeling a part of anything, right? Still another experience. Chapter on 100, page 137. Still another experience. She wanted to know if her husband's company's insurance was still in force 4 days before he had hanged himself. So we've got three descriptions of suicide in the first two pages of this chapter. You know, everybody thinks I'm going to get on, and when I talk about two employers, I'm going to get on and talk about the work stuff. That ain't what this is about, man. We have a chronic, potentially fatal illness that has a known repeatable solution, right? Food plan and the 12 steps, right? Here were three exceptional men lost to this world because I did not understand alcoholism as I do now. What an irony, I became an alcoholic myself. But for the intervention of an understanding person, and I'll give you a little more about that because that's what happened to me. I had the intervention of an understanding person. I got 12-stepped into Overeaters Anonymous at the International AA Convention in Atlanta in 2015. So if you think you're a little wacky, I got 12-stepped. I had to fly 2,000 miles from my home to Atlanta, Georgia, to get 12-stepped into Overeaters Anonymous. I got 12-stepped by a member of another 12-step fellowship at a 12-step convention to come home and find my home group a mile from my house. You know, come on. But that's how I roll, right? I mean, it's what a gift. What a gift to have that experience. And I'll tell you more detail about that in a little bit, but let's keep going with the chapter. Nearly every modern employer feels a moral responsibility for the well-being of his help, and he tries to meet these responsibilities. You know, I had a lot of people in my career when I was gaining weight express concern, employers especially. Right? Like, are you doing okay? You're missing, you know, I notice you're missing some time. Everything all right? Right? They would express their concern. And what I would turn that into is resentment. Like, well, it's none of your business. And all they're doing is expressing concern. Right? That's how I roll. I take your concern and weaponize it against you. Right? If we turn the page to 138, or actually 139, and think about this in the context of you know, sponsees, right? I sponsor people, obviously, in Overeaters Anonymous. That's my responsibility and my obligation. Once having had a spiritual experience, I have to sponsor. It's not, you know, people act like sponsoring people's optional. Good luck with that, by the way. You might want to read Working with Others like every day for a month until it registers in your head that if you want to stay clean and have a vital, meaningful recovery, sponsorship is something that we need to do. Right. If you're not carrying the message, it's a selfish, at that point, it's, you know, this program is designed to take your experience into the world and share it with other people. So what it's, that's the end result. And if you're not doing that, who's in the way? I'm pretty sure it's not your higher power. You know, one of my buddies said, you know, well, I'll stay abstinent today, God willing. And I always say back to him, I'm pretty sure God's willing. Are you? Are you willing to go to any length today to stay clean? Are you willing to be inconvenienced and spend, you know, 30 to 40 minutes with a sponsee on the phone trying to work something out, or maybe going to see him if they're local to you, right? What are you willing to do? Oh, Patrick, you take it a little too serious. Okay. Fair enough. My experience has been near fatality. That's been my experience. I relapsed in a hospital with food. I had gone in. I'd been having lesions on my feet for quite some time because both my feet are basically numb, what's left of my feet. And they'd been numb for quite some time due to the chronic neuropathy caused by type 2 diabetes, which was directly related to my compulsive overeating and my morbid obesity. And I was in the hospital because the infection in my right foot had gotten pretty serious, and they had recommended IV antibiotics. And the antibiotics they gave me didn't touch the infection. So we went through this course of actions that resulted in me being needed to be put on vancomycin, which is, that's it. That's the last gasp. Vancomycin is an antibiotic that's much like, just think of chemo for cancer. And it's a very powerful antibiotic. You can only tolerate 2 IV bags of it. That's what they told me. Otherwise, it'll damage your kidneys and do that kind of thing, right? And by the way, I'm missing work. I'm on FMLA from work, which is family and medical leave here in the States. So I'm out on a 12-week leave from work at this point because of this damage that I'd done to myself with this compulsive overeating. And I'm in recovery at this point. But I'm not really doing the deal the way I need to do the deal, right? And sort of mailing in my inventories on a regular basis. I'm checking the mechanical boxes of weighing and measuring my food and doing all that, but it's not with a spiritual, it's not really in a spiritually fit way, if that makes any sense. I'm following my food plan, I'm calling my sponsor and reporting my food daily. I'm compliant. Because I'm experiencing weight loss and things are good. My health is getting better. I'm starting to get some of these tangible rewards, but I'm not really spiritually fit. And I get to the hospital. And they come in one morning and they say, if these numbers on your infection, so the infectious disease doctor had gotten involved and it turns out I had a MRSA infection. And they said that if the vancomycin doesn't take care of this infection, we're going to amputate your leg from above the knee because the infection will go systemic and kill you if we don't. So in the matter of hours, I've gone from losing two toes to losing my leg above my knee. And because I'm not spiritually fit, I get angry. Right? I get mad.
That's a gentle and what's reminder really going, for 30 minutes, just so you know, but you. Keep going.
Thank you. So they tell me this and I get fearful. I get angry. And then I'm supposed to get an evening snack, a metabolic snack sent up from the cafeteria at the hospital, and they miss it. Now, I had brought some things with me because I knew that these kinds of things, you know, I've been in and out of the hospital a fair amount with this problem at this point. And I, you know, I had some things, but the thing I didn't do is I wasn't accountable. The agreement I had with my sponsor is that if I drifted off of my, if anything went sour with my food plan for the day that I had reported to her, that I would make a call or text. And I didn't do that. Dishonesty. And I binged on a can of cashews. An entire pound can of cashews. So my relapse story isn't one of, I went to a five-star restaurant and had a wonderful giant steak and half a chocolate cake or something like that. I'm in a gown with the back open, you know, those nice hospital gowns they give you, right? Eating cashews out of a can. In the middle of the night, knowing that if I do that, they can't do surgery because I'm not fasting. So I'm in the hospital about to experience serious consequences of my illness, and it doesn't keep me abstinent because I'm the guy on page 24. I have no effective mental defense against the first bite. I have to have a power greater than myself in my life. I have to be able to pick up the phone and make a call and say, what do I do? They didn't send up my snack. And you know what she would have told me to do? She just said, do you have your portable scale? I would have said, yes. She'd say, weigh out X amount of cashews and ask them for a carton of milk and you'll be okay. That's what she would have said. That's all it would have been. But I wouldn't make the call. Because I'm an extreme example of self-will run riot, and I usually don't think so. Now, I restarted my abstinence date the next day, right? I fasted for 24 hours. Thankfully, after that dark night of the soul, the numbers on my infection had moved sufficiently for them to do the surgery, and all I lost was those two toes that day. But I am such a... You know, I pull my socks on every day over these stumps on my feet. And it's a spiritual act for me to be able to do that because it's a visceral reminder to me about what self-will will do to me. I'm okay with it today because you know, I spent a month in the Rocky Mountains this summer running around like a little, like a 25-year-old kid. I'm 64 years old. I'm 195 pounds. I'm in the best health I've been in 35 years. I'm physically as fit as I can be, right? Yes, I have problems with my feet, right? But I have special boots. I have orthotics in my shoes, and I can go and do things that I never thought I could go and do. And I certainly couldn't do them when I was 420 pounds and telling you that I was living a spiritual life. And people say to me, well, you weigh and measure all your food. What's that? That for me is a spiritual act. I'm not telling anybody else they have to do that. For me, putting food on a scale is a spiritual thing because it takes care of the vessel that the spirit lives in. And I found something out that a healthy spirit can't live in a sick temple. That's my experience. So if we go back to the chapter, it says, when dealing with an alcoholic, there may be a natural annoyance down at the bottom of 139, a natural annoyance that a man could be so weak, stupid, and irresponsible. You know, if my sponsor throws in the towel that day, or if they throw in the towel at me at work, where am I? Because I was certainly believing, looking to be weak, stupid, and irresponsible. Even when you will, when you understand the malady better, you may feel this feeling rising. That's one of the reasons we need to be spiritually fit, because our sponsees are going to be challenging at times, right? The people around us will be challenging at times. Next page. Can you discard the feeling that you are only dealing with only with habit, with stubbornness, or a weak will? If this presents difficulty, rereading chapters 2 and 3, where the alcoholic sickness is discussed at length, might be worthwhile. You as a businessman want to know the necessities before considering the result. If you concede that your employee or sponsee is ill, can it be forgiven for what he has done in the past? Can you, his past absurdities be forgotten? You know, one of the things I'll hear about people in 12-step fellowships, you know, the people that struggle with relapse, and I'm one of them, right? I had two, and I've had two in Overeaters Anonymous, is, well, you didn't want it bad enough. Bleep you. I wanted it with every fiber of my being. I couldn't get there because I was powerless. And it took a responsible, recovered member of this fellowship to grab me by the hand and walk me through it. You can't tell what's in a person's heart. To comment on someone's desire is, I think, one of the most possibly damaging things we can do. Now, you can indicate that they're not taking the correct actions to get there. That you can do. You can redirect. You can share your experience. Well, he doesn't want it bad enough. Nice. You must judge yourself harshly as well. It's easy to judge people in 12-step fellowships. It really is. But I love the people that struggle with relapse. I go to them all the time, and I look them right in the eye, and I put my hand on their shoulder, and I do the same thing somebody did for me, and that's, you don't have to live like this. You can be free. Because I am free. I live freely. Can it be appreciated that he has been a victim of crooked thinking directly caused by the action of alcohol on his brain? You know, if people are in the middle of binges, and they're still showing up at the meeting, we need to treat them with dignity and love and kindness and accountability at a high level. If you want what we have, you have to do what we do. I'm sorry it's like that. Trust me, I investigated the house for all the side doors. Hell, I looked for the attic window to go out of. There ain't any, not for a guy like me. I have to use all the tools of Overeaters Anonymous on a daily basis in order to stay abstinent. And in that abstinence, that's when I can be available for a spiritual experience as the result of working the steps. You know, the doctor writes that a man's brain needs to be cleared, right? I usually ask somebody to at least refrain from binging for a couple of 3 days before we start to work in the steps. Because it's hard to have a spiritual experience if you're ill. Next page, 141. This is not to say that all alcoholics are honest and upright when not drinking. Of course, this isn't so, and such people may often impose on you. Seeing your attempt to understand and help, some men will try to take advantage of your kindness. If you're sure your man does not want to stop, he may well be discharged, the sooner the better. Consequences, right? You know, if I sponsor people that just are consistently not willing to take the actions indicated, I just respectfully decline to engage. But I do that respectfully. I know you might find that hard to believe on this talk, but I do it respectfully. You're not doing him a favor by keeping him on. Firing such an individual may prove a blessing to him. It may be just the jolt he needs. I know in my own particular case that nothing my company could have done would have stopped me so long as I was able to hold my position. I could not possibly realize how serious my situation was. There's that question. Is it possible you're in more trouble than you think you are? What's your current spiritual condition? That's a question my sponsor asks me pretty regularly, my OA sponsor. She'll ask me once, twice a week, what's your current spiritual condition? And by the way, if you're the only one assessing that, I live on a daily basis, a level of accountability that is just above comfortable, just above uncomfortable. It is uncomfortable. I am accountable, right? I take actions each day that ensure my abstinence from the food so that I'm available for the spiritual experience. Because that's what it takes for me to remain abstinent, have a return to health. That's just my experience. I can't make decisions about food. Now, does that mean that I don't design what I eat every day? No, I do. I design what I eat every day because I have a plan from a nutritionist that I follow very closely. Right? I weigh and measure everything that goes in my mouth, including at restaurants. I was at a really nice restaurant last night. You know how many people were interested in me weighing and measuring at the restaurant? One, me. Nobody cared. You know what people care about when you do that at a restaurant? What they're going to eat. Turns out I'm not that big a deal. I was so scared of that when I first started doing it at restaurants. I was so worried somebody was going to say something. And I found out, yeah, it turns out I ain't that big a deal. Nobody really cares what I'm doing with food. Really, nobody does. That was a gift. Well, what will people think? Who cares? I have a fatal affliction. And if they have a problem with me treating that, guess what? Pound sand. That's seriously. I'm going to do what I need to do to live well so I'm available for my family. I've got these two little grandnieces. One's named Rose. The other one's named Georgia. And I am the uncle that ruins parenting, good parenting. They have wonderful parents, and I do my best to spoil that on a regular basis, right? They're 1-7, 1-8, right? And I'm the guy, you know, I slip them $20 bills. I take them places they're not supposed to go, right? And I do that not in a mean way, but as in the, you know, the uncle that spoils the kids way, right? And I wouldn't be able to experience that with them if somebody wouldn't have challenged my belief systems around this illness. I wouldn't be available. Jessica, I see you with that child. It's beautiful that you're here in recovery with that child. That's what this is about. It's about putting us in a position to be of service, maximum service to God and our fellows, including our children, including our parents, including our siblings, right? A more important demonstration of these principles in our homes, occupations, and affairs. That means I will show up at work as a fit employee, that when I struggle with something at work, I will handle that in a dignified way. And if you think I'm 100% on that, you haven't been listening to this thing under my nose run, because it runs. And sometimes it gets me in a lot of trouble. But I know how to clean that up now. I'm the director of a large rehabilitation center here in Minneapolis, 140-bed rehabilitation center for chronic street-level addicts. I work for the Salvation Army. And I have to be spiritually fit in my work. And I was doing that kind of work when I was suffering from morbid obesity, and I was doing people a disservice. And I had a lot of amends to clean up with that. I really did. Because I didn't show up in that environment as in the condition that I needed to. I lacked integrity, right? I lacked discipline. I lacked commitment to the mission of the job, which is to be of service to these people, to help them find a way to rebuild their lives from homelessness and addiction. And introduce them, by the way, to the myriad of 12-step fellowships that are available to treat them, because that's what I do. I love this one, especially as it applies here in Overeaters Anonymous. In the paragraph where it says, if your man accepts your offer, in other words, if you're working with somebody and they you know, say, okay, let's do this. Let's find some abstinence. It should be pointed out that physical treatment is but a small part of the picture. You know, my weight loss is profound. It's a great entry point, but that's not why I'm here. I came, you know, we have that thing in Overeaters Anonymous where it says, you know, I came for the vanity and I stayed for the sanity. That was my case. I wanted to lose weight and look better. I wanted to be lighter, right? And what happened was, is I got spiritually fit. I got sane. And by spiritual fitness, I mean, I'm messy. You can probably tell that I might be kind of a messy dude. Right? On the end, like, you know, but I live directed by others, hopefully who are connected to a power greater than themselves. I live directed by my own higher power and the dictates of that, right? Which is the fact that I have a prayer and meditation life, right? That I engage, I don't act impulsively nearly as much as I used to. I still, you know, occasionally obviously make mistakes, but I have a daily discipline in which I can see that, report it to someone, and clean it up if it needs to be cleaned up. I do written 10 step on a daily basis. And you know what the joy of that is? A lot of people will say, well, you write your 10, all you're looking at is how selfish. No, I end up writing no to those questions quite a bit because I'm better. And it sort of happened without my permission. It turns out I got tired of looking at how I was showing up like a donkey every day. And I got less donkey-like. Funny how that works. Change is actually available. But I needed guidance. Though you are providing him with the best possible attention, medical attention, he should understand that he must undergo a change of heart. That's what I'm speaking about in this paragraph. Are you undergoing a change of heart? Not just the physical transformation, but a real change of heart. Are you less resentful? Are you less fearful? Are you more loving and kind towards the people around you? Right? How are you showing up day to day? Are you willing to have hard conversations with people? In a respectful and kind way. I am. I have hard conversations. I'm skilled in conflict resolution. I'm the guy in the building that I work in where when it's really rough, the words go out and it says, we need Patrick. And I'm not that guy because I'm the guy, you know, I was raised in an alcoholic home where I was witness to and victim of things that no child should be witness to or victim of. And I'd love to tell you that's why I'm a compulsive overeater and an alcoholic, but it's got nothing to do with it. It's why I've spent a lot of money on therapy in my recovery. It's why I've had to treat my trauma, right? I've had to do all those things, but I needed recovery as the platform to do that from. The reason I'm a compulsive overeater and an alcoholic is I have a physical allergy to alcohol, sugar, white flour, go down the list. And I have a mind that tells me I can override the physiological fact that when I eat white bread, I will eat the whole loaf. And I have a desperate attachment to being right that I can override it. So I continue the cycle. One of the things I found out my first four step in Overeaters Anonymous was that my need to be able to be in control was what was killing me. My attachment to being right. I simply couldn't admit to myself that I had this second thing. And more importantly, I couldn't admit to myself that I knew about that I needed you guys in this fellowship. There's a funny thing that somebody said to me, like the second OA meeting I was at, I had this little beautiful woman, her name's Rita, short little thing, lost a bunch of weight and is just as spiritually fit. She's got one of those big books that's just frayed at the edges and it's got bookmarks jammed in it. You know, it's just beautiful. And she just emanates the enthusiasm of recovery. And she's about 4 foot, whatever, and just a spark plug of a human being. And she said, oh, Patrick, your credits from AA don't transfer here. Right? Because, you know, she just looked through me like I was a clean window. I had this well-developed recovery ego from my other fellowship. I had knowledge. I had experience of what this was, but I didn't have authentic recovery because I was dying and she knew it. I needed you. I needed your experience. I needed the ability to identify with your stories and your recoveries, right? We go on to the next paragraph. We all had to place recovery above everything. For without recovery, we would have lost both home and business. Where are you at with that idea in your life right now? And does it reflect it? Is your recovery priority one? And if it ain't, that's hard because we live in a busy world, man. We live in a world that's got a gigantic amount of distractions. And we are people that will attach to distractions. You know, I mean, I've done a really good job in the last 4 or 5 years of being very spiritually mindful of what I consume. Not just food, information, content. And that doesn't mean that I live in echo chambers. I am very aware of where we are in the world, because I'm involved in the treatment of the afflictions that causes. Right? You know, I work with people who have severe persistent mental illness, chronic addiction, chronic homelessness. I work with the results of it. In the society that we've got, and their lack of ability to sustain employment, right? To stay to the chapter. Can you have every confidence in his ability to recover? While on the subject of his confidence, can you adopt the attitude that so far as you are concerned, this will be a strictly personal matter? that his alcoholic derelictions, the treatment about to be undertaken, will never be discussed without his consent. Where are we at with protecting our anonymity? You know, one of the things that I was surprised to learn when I came to OA is that anonymity is respected at a slightly higher level here than it was in my other fellowship, at least in the circles that I travel. Okay. I need to be clear about that. I can't speak for AA as a whole, but in the circles that I was traveling, we weren't that protective of anonymity. And I think it's one of the things I've learned over here is that it's a really important factor, right? Now, I love this part at the bottom. To return to the subject matter of this book, it contains full suggestions by which the employee may solve his problem. If you're out there struggling, what we have in this book is a known, repeatable solution to your problem. And your problem isn't in the refrigerator, and it's not at the grocery store, and it's not at the drive-thru. And it's not in your ability or inability to eat if you're a restrictor or a bulimic. My sponsor is a restrictor and a bulimic. And I'm, you know, somebody that suffered from morbid obesity. So the natures of our affliction regarding food don't combat because we're working in recovery, right? To use some of the ideas which contain it are novel. Perhaps you are not quite in sympathy with the approach we suggest. Yeah, when my sponsor started suggesting daily calls for accountability purposes, I was not on board. And she said, kindly work with somebody else. Because I had an opinion about an experience I hadn't had yet. Contempt prior to investigation. So I committed to doing it for 2 weeks. And guess what? At the end of the 2 weeks, the obsession with food had been removed. I don't obsess about food ever anymore. Because at 5:45 Central Time every morning, I'm on the phone with my sponsor reporting to her everything that's going to go in my mouth for the day. And I eat food that I love. I cook a lot. I weigh and measure everything. And the results speak for themselves. You saw the photos, right? And I have the freedom to speak openly about living in recovery, and I'm not perfect. God knows I'm not perfect, right? You were betting, of course, that your changed attitude down at the bottom of 144, and I'll wrap up here in a minute. You're betting, of course, that your changed attitude plus the contents of the book will turn the trick. In some cases, it will, and in others, it may not. But we think that if you persevere, the percentage of successes will gratify you. As our work spreads and our numbers increase, we hope your employees may be put in personal contact with some of us. That means, you know, the members of 12-Step Fellowship. When I'm asked at work by people who know I'm in recovery about how I do this, I'm pretty, you know, I keep it private, but I'm pretty willing to share it, right? And I think it's important for all of us to do that when it's appropriate. So I want to just briefly, I was at that convention in 2015. I was sitting on a bench wheezing because I had just finished walking about 500 feet. And at that point, that's what happened to it. I was sweaty and wheezing and I was dying. And the woman in that photograph that I put up, the woman in the photograph who was somebody that had met me at an AA seminar sometime before, she's an OA member and her husband in that photo is an AA member. And they've allowed me to bust their anonymity. I have permission to share this here because they think the story is so profound. She came over and asked me how I was doing. She recognized me and I recognized her. And we weren't friends at that point. We were acquaintances. We were just people who knew each other from traveling in the same circles. And she came over and she sat down next to me and she said, Patrick, how you doing? And I have one standard response at 420 pounds, dying of type 2 diabetes. I'm fine. And she grabbed me by the hand and squeezed it and looked me in the eye and she said, "Patrick, how you doing?" And I said, "Again, I'm fine." And she looked me in the eye and said, "Patrick, you're full of shit. You're dying." And as a responsible recovered member of Overeaters Anonymous, I can't let it happen in front of me without telling you what happened to me. And she proceeded to tell me her story. Now, mind you, she's got a prosthetic leg. And she'd had her leg removed as a result of type 2 diabetes. She's not very tall. She's a little thing. At one point, she's under 5 feet tall, and she'd weighed over 270 pounds. And she's normally weighted now. And she lost her leg. And she 12-stepped me right there, then and there. At the International AA Convention in 2015 in Atlanta, Georgia, I got 12-stepped into Overeaters Anonymous. Now, I was so happy with that occasion that I went home and ate like a madman for a month because bleep you, honestly. Who you telling? You know, I know the first 164 pages of the big book, blah, 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 blah. But I went to a meeting on one Sunday night. I woke up and I was willing and I knew I was going to go. And I don't know how that happened. I do know that it's, you know, God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. And I went to that meeting. And after the meeting was over, somebody else asked me another very penetrating, annoying question. And that question was, what are you going to have for breakfast? Well, aren't you intrusive? And I said, I don't know. And he said, you know, I have a food plan. I'm about your size. Why don't you try this? And then we'll get you to a nutritionist. You can get a food plan going and we'll get you started in Overeaters Anonymous. Because that's the way this meeting did it. So I found myself in a grocery store about 30 minutes later. And I bought the food that was indicated and I started my abstinence. I've had two slips. But I've been here 8 years. And I hope that what I represent is the path that we can take to recovery in Overeaters Anonymous. I'm really grateful for the time that you've allowed me to spend with you today. And I'm happy to answer any questions as we move through this. I know what I say can sometimes be disturbing. All I would ask is that you look at what was disturbed, not who disturbed it. Look at what was disturbed, not who disturbed it. I'll pass.
Thank you so much, Patrick. Yeah, thank you for sharing your experience, strength, and hope with us today. And we will now be transitioning into the question and answer segment. I'd like to introduce Joanne B., who is our moderator today. Thank you.
I thank you so much, Z. Thank you, Patrick. Thank you for your time and your wisdom and your sharing. Hello, my name is Joanne. I am a compulsive eater and your moderator today. The chat is open. Please continue to send me your questions. I'm looking for questions from the group on our topic today, to employers, and on anything that you've heard from the share, because we've covered so many topics. So anything that you've heard, please send those to me in the chat and we'll get to as many as we can. We will do our first question. Let me just go to the first question. Patrick, coming back to you, and I know you're on mute, so just getting you to unmute again. This question was sent early on and it said, you talked about lacking commitment and the willingness to go to any length, like that turnaround at the beginning. Can you describe your turn from lacking commitment and the willingness to go to any length? Was it a spiritual experience, a moment, or a slow growth for you, that spiritual awakening? How did it happen for you?
You know, it's interesting. I think it might have been a combination of all three of those things, right? One of the problems I had coming from the Grandfather Fellowship is you know, obviously, as a member of that, I had stopped drinking, right? But here, I had to eat. So there was all this noise around, well, when, how much, how, you know, how do I do this? I mean, I literally needed like I needed my hand held to figure out how to get abstinent. I had never known what that looked like. I had always ate what I wanted, when I wanted, how I wanted for my entire life, right? So the mechanics of it were where the commitment was sketchy. I was interested, and it was suggested to me by my sponsor, why don't you start asking for willingness every morning? And she would refer to she said, what did you do at the beginning of your sobriety in AA? And I said, well, you know, I prayed. I asked God, my higher power, for willingness. She said, well, you know, you might want to consider doing that over here too, boss. Knock, knock, Puddinhead. Which I did. And it started to change. The other thing that happened was, as I said, I did the food plan, and in 2 weeks, the obsession was removed. It was that fast for me. And that's what helped really up my willingness to continue to do these things that seemed like they were absurd. And now they're just routine. They're a part of my life. They're natural. They're, you know, I've traveled overseas doing what I do. I pack food on airplanes. I fly around a lot. I mean, I do a little bit of travel for work. I get to fly in support of my fellowships. I can maintain abstinence on the run, pretty easily. So it was just really, I think for me, it was a matter of change is hard and routine helps with change. Just does.
Thank you. The next question, can you go back to the words permanent recovery in the OA food program? How do you see that in our food programs where we eat every day?
Well, we maintain abstinence, right? I mean, what permanent recovery means to me is what it says on page 19 is that I'm demonstrating these principles, the principles of spiritual living in my homes, occupations, and affairs. And I'm not obsessing about food. I'm not overly self-involved, right? And let's look at the context in which that permanent recovery is stated. It's on, now the Roman numerals might be different in your book. I have a fourth edition, but it's an abbreviated fourth edition. It's the first 164 pages. I have it on, it's on the second page of the forward to the second edition. Just go to that page in your book and then flip it and look at the bottom of the next page where it says the physician had repeatedly tried spiritual means. They're talking about Dr. Bob here, right? The other founder of AA had repeatedly tried spiritual means to resolve his alcoholic dilemma, but it failed. But when the broker gave him Dr. Silkworth's description of alcoholism and its hopelessness, the physician began to pursue the spiritual remedy for his malady with a willingness he had never before been able to muster. He sobered never to drink again up to the moment of his death in 1950. This seemed to prove that no one alcoholic could affect another as no non-alcoholic could. It also indicated that strenuous work, one alcoholic with another, was vital to permanent recovery. Are you sponsoring people? Plain and simple. If you've worked all the steps, are you working with others? Because that's how you achieve permanent recovery. You continue to work with others, right? And all it says is it's available. And then let's go to the first story after the first 164, Dr. Bob's nightmare. And it reinforces this principle. In the italics before his story starts, it says, a co-founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, the birth of our society dates from his first day of permanent sobriety, June 10th, 1935. Now remember, Dr. Bob struggled. He got sober, then he relapsed real hard. And what did he go out and do? He finished his amends. He had been doing everything else, but he didn't do the amends because Dr. Bob, this is a bit indelicate, but he was a proctologist who had done surgery on people under the influence. Right. Think about that. Now, do you have any amends that that involve doing surgery under the influence? Maybe somebody does, but I didn't. None of mine were that serious. Right. But he had to go out and say, hey, I treated you and but then he was permanently sober after that. And then it says, look what it says. In 1950, the year of his death, he carried the AA message to 1950, the year of his death. He carried the AA message to more than 5,000 alcoholic men and women. Dr. Bob was sober some 15 years. If you do the math on that 5,000, now not all of them stayed sober. Let's not get goofy here. He just carried the message to that many. That's about 3 a day, every day, for 15 years. Are you carrying the message to 3 people a day? Just saying. It's available. Permanent recovery is available. Those are the context in which I use that permanent recovery. It doesn't really have to do anything to do with eating or not. It's in this area of, am I acting on behalf of other people as a result of a spiritual experience?
Thank you. Thank you, Patrick. The next question, and I am looking for questions. So if something is coming to you, please put it in the chat. Next question, Patrick, if you have started working with a sponsee and they relapse, they go back into the food, do you suggest we take a break from doing the steps until they have a few days abstinence? And can you describe that? Do you go back to the beginning? What do you do?
Yeah, I typically, there's the fact of, you know, a man's brain needs to be cleared. So we do need maybe a day or two of abstinence. But what I always do is, listen, there's a lot of oral tradition BS about why people relapse in these fellowships. There's one reason. They haven't admitted to their innermost selves that they're compulsive overeaters, like the book says. It's a first step issue. Always. I get people that come to me all the time and say, you know, I struggled when I got to step 4. That's because you don't believe to your innermost self that for you to eat is to die, to overeat is to die. Because I do. I believe that for me to overeat is to die. I'm clear on step 1. And if you're clear on step 1, it doesn't mean that the rest of it's going to be perfect. So when I have somebody that relapses, I always go back and talk about step 1. And oftentimes what happens is what I spoke about earlier, is that people get stuck on the dash. They're willing to admit that they're powerless over food and sort of do the mechanical abstinence thing, but they're going to manage other areas of their life, right? And their internal dialogue becomes unmanageable as a result of self-will run riot, though they usually don't think so. The first 43 pages of the big book are dedicated to one singular idea, that you live in a state of complete delusion around your disease, and you need a God, a power greater than yourself, in order to achieve sanity again. Where do you stand today with that question? Not 5 years ago, not in the future, right here, right now. And I don't care if you've been in this fellowship for 5 minutes or 50 years. Where do you stand today with that? And that's rowdy. People don't like to hear it. But it is always a first step issue. You clearly believed that there would be some reward from you binge eating again, or whatever it is, restricting, whatever it is, returning to that behavior. When you have demonstrative periods of absolute insanity, right? It's a hard one. And guess what? Some people never get there. One of the things I think that people get tripped up of in 12-step fellowships is the idea that you're going to watch people die. You're going to watch him die right in front of you. I held my brother in my arms at 7 years sober, watching him die of alcoholism. I had a big book in one hand, and he was dying of liver failure right in front of my eyes in a hospice at 5:17 in the morning on September 8th of 2011. I'm familiar with the back end of this thing. It's never pretty. People will expire in hospitals all over the world tonight because of this disease, food addiction. And they will call it heart disease, and they will call it liver failure, and they will call it kidney, and they will call it everything except what it is. And we have a known repeatable solution.
Yeah, thank you, Patrick. There's a just coming on to the next question that was brought up. It leads a little into what you were just sharing there. Your obsession with food was relieved. What about fear? What about anxiety? What about other addictions? So you came in and were sharing that same message in the other fellowship, and yet eating every day. So, so what do you do when you put down the food, but you're still using in other areas? Where is that spiritual fitness? How do we find it? How do we hold on to it?
Repetition of the work, right? So I have a daily discipline. I have a commitment to a daily discipline with this work, and it evolves over time. It's not instant. Did I still, you know, when the obsession with food was removed, did I experience fear and anxiety at a level I had never experienced it because I hadn't been authentically clean since I was a little kid? It was vicious. But if you're here because you're seeking comfort, I'm here to report to you that ain't what we do here. We find serenity and peace. But what good has seeking comfort ever done you? It got you to the fellowship. So maybe an experience with fear, an experience with anxiety, experience with doubt, an experience with taking actions you don't understand and getting results you can't deny, building faith, right, is what is needed. This is not about being okay immediately. It takes time. It's an evolution. It's a process. We have to grow in understanding and effectiveness, as the book asks us to do. And we do that by being in the service of other people as soon as possible. If you're here looking for comfort, the spiritual path is not one of comfort. It is one of disturbance and growth. And in that, you will find immense freedom, meaningful peace, and meaningful serenity. That's been my experience. My question is always this: how free do you want to be?
Thank you, Patrick. We want to keep moving with the questions, and then just looking at the time, we will start to wrap up so that we will have some time when we were not recording, and you'll be able to talk directly and ask your questions directly if you would like to. So I've got another two questions here, or a few actually have come in. So you mentioned accountability is uncomfortable. I agree with this and battle it daily. How do you reconcile any defiance against accountability? I am very defiant at times.
Yeah, so am I. I just do it anyway. One of the things that if you think that sawing a strawberry, or this morning I cut a raspberry in half to make 6 ounces. If you think that shit was on my list of life accomplishments to do twice a week, you're out of your mind. I get really defiant about that, but I do it. Defiance and resistance are like boats on a river. They come through. You don't have to get on every boat you see come through by the river, and especially not that one that's got a hole in the bottom, right? I'm defiant. Yes, I have resistance. One of the things that I do is I pray and meditate, right? And I asked for these things to be removed in my step six work. And here's what I would report to you. Defiance is a character defect when it comes to recovery. It blocks you from the grace of your higher power. In step six, it says, if we still cling to something we won't let go, your defiance, we ask God to help us be willing. And then there's the seven-step prayer. And then there's the amends instructions. And in the amends instructions, it says, if we resist, we turn again to, and we ask until the willingness comes. Do you have a higher power in your life or not? Do you believe? I ruthlessly trust my God to provide me with what I need. And if it's hard some days, it's just supposed to be. That doesn't mean that I don't seek out some condolence and some, that's where the fellowship is so important for me, because I can roll up on one of my buddies at the meeting and say, God damn, man, this week I've been in my head. I've been up against it. We can share that with one another. Like the person who asked the question just shared it. I am defiant. Welcome. Welcome. That's what this fellowship's about. You think anybody showed up here? Oh, I want to be, I'm so glad I'm a compulsive overeater. That ain't the way it went with me. I had to be dying to get dragged in here. So, yeah, if you're defiant, welcome. We have a known repeatable solution. Sponsor up, be accountable. And even in your defiance, you can still take the actions you need to take. You don't have to attach to any of it. That's one of the spiritual gifts I've had from meditation, is realizing that the stuff that comes through my head doesn't require my attention. Just doesn't.
Yeah. Thank you, Patrick. So I'm wanting to bring you back to a past question and get really specific. So come back to that sponsee who's picked up, they're in the food, and the question is asking, go back to that. Do you go to them through step one again? What do you do that's different? Yeah. They're using.
No,
what do you do when you come back to them?
When I come back to them, I say, we're going to start over because it's clear that something was missed. And typically it is step one and then their version of a power greater than themselves, right? Steps one, two, and three are key. If something's been left out of a fourth or a fifth step, it's because they don't trust, right? If something's been intentionally, and most things that get left off of fourth or a fifth steps are intentionally left off, right? It's because they don't trust God. They don't trust their fellows. They don't trust the fellowship, right? So we might need to revisit step two, right? And one of the ways that I introduce people to a power greater than himself in that is obviously you read the instructions, right? And it says that's exactly what this book is about. Can you continue to take all the actions that the big book asks you to take and see if God doesn't show up? You know, this idea that you're going to have some overwhelming God consciousness 15 days absence, that certainly wasn't my experience. But yes, I typically take them back to the beginning and start over, because there's clearly something missing. And if they're not willing to do that, then you know what you have. You have pride, right? Or you have a need for them. See, one of the things that people get hung up on in here is this idea that you're supposed to be in with the cool kids, you know, the people that are recovered or whatever, and not messy. No, we're messy. Be messy. Just be broken. Be a mess. Be just wrecked. That's what this thing's about. There's no place. There's nothing to achieve here except abstinence and spiritual fitness. So you can go help another person. So yeah, I start over.
You start over. Thank you, Patrick. I'm going to, just looking at the time, I do need to wind up the question and answer part that's on the recording. I'm going to hand back to our chair, and there will be some time after we stop the recording. So if we didn't get to your question, please hang around and ask it when we finish the meeting. Thank you so much. I'm handing back to you, Z.
Okay, thank you, Joanne. Okay, according to our seventh edition, we are fully self-supporting through our own contributions. As we have now moved to virtual meetings, it is important that we continue to be fully self-supporting. This allows Overeaters Anonymous to continue to carry the message to those who still suffer. You are able to send your donations through our website, which is www.ad4l.info. For those of you able to see the Zoom chat, the link will also be posted there. And thank you all for your support. It is much appreciated. Our next meeting is, a reminder that a Design for Living, our Big Book OA meeting, is a daily meeting. We are based out of Melbourne, Australia. The recordings from today's workshop will be available on our website, where you can also find out about our other upcoming events and speakers. Visit our website, as I mentioned, www.ad4l.info. Our next monthly series speaker meeting will be held on Sunday, December the 10th, 7:30 a.m. to 9 a.m, but that's in Melbourne, Australia time. And the topic is A Vision for You. We hope to see you there. And in closing, I'd like to thank you all for your service in coming here today. By following the 12 steps, attending meetings regularly, and using the OA tools, we are changing our lives. You will find hope and encouragement in Overeaters Anonymous. To the newcomer, we suggest attending at least 6 different meetings to learn the many ways that OA can help you. The opinions expressed here today are of those of individual OA members and do not represent OA as a whole. Please remember our commitment to honor each other's anonymity. What you hear here, whom you see here, when you leave here, please let it stay here. And let us all reach out by phone or email to newcomers, returning members, and each other, because together we get better. And to close the meeting, Catherine will please unmute and read the promises. Thank you, Catherine.
Thanks so much, Lee. Hi, I'm Catherine. I'm a compulsive overeater. I'll just read the promises. If we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. We are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past, nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity, and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. The feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle the situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? We think not. They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always materialize if we work for them.